Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. I've been using Boris Effects products for almost 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, it's my pleasure to speak with Ace Eddie winning and Emmy winning editor Taylor Mason, ACE, about the film Birth Rebirth, which was in theaters earlier this year and is now available on Amazon Prime or Apple TV. Previously, Taylor has edited A Black Lady Sketch Show, Dahmer, Monster, The Jeffrey Dahmer Story, and Pose. She's also been an assistant editor on Blade Runner 2049, Dune, and DC League of Super Pets. Before I hop into our discussion with Taylor, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free, no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for almost 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Taylor Mason, ACE, discusses editing Birth Rebirth.
Thank you for having me. I'm ecstatic to finally be on Art of the Cut. It's a bucket list item that I've had for a while. I'm just so thankful that you gave me the opportunity to cross it off, basically.
I gotta say, I am not a horror movie fan, and you just scared the crap out of me.
I'm so sorry, but I'm also so happy to hear that. It's kind of the best news I could receive about this movie.
One of the things that I loved was just the beginning. Talk to me a little bit about that opening montage. The shots are very close, very claustrophobic. There's some jump cutting in there. You've got the audience very on edge, kind of wondering, what's this ride that I'm going on?
Well, that was definitely the intention. You know, the script was so well considered, and they'd worked on it for such a long time before. I mean, I think over a couple of years, they revisited the script and just tailored it and made sure every beat was well represented, well thought out, and well balanced. But they still kind of allowed room for the collaborators to bring their own kind of objective experience to the film. And I took advantage of moments like the first minute or so, where you're supposed to be immersed in the woman coding in and out of consciousness, and it's supposed to feel chaotic and disorienting. And so all those decisions, those jump cuts, the fades to black, were just in an effort to immerse the audience in the character and feel as terrified as she was, and therefore be engaged from the first frame to the end of that kind of section. It was fun to play with. There were a lot of different ways to kind of play that opening scene, but I think the instinct was correct, and it felt good that the director, Laura Moss, just confirmed that when they saw it.
There's sound, even under the black and under the logos, you're hearing stuff. Do you want to talk about creating that soundscape or how much of that you did in your cut compared to what the sound designers did?
That actually might have been scripted, the sound under black. I don't know if I remember that correctly. Either way, the point was to get the audience to start asking questions. Where is this sound coming from? Why am I hearing it? And to try to piece together what it might mean before we get to the first image. So they're immediately immersed in the story with the sound design, and then you jump to picture to me, the image of the eye is already telling us so much about, you know, what we're seeing, who we're looking at, and how they're feeling. This eye, the way it was shot, how close it was, the contrast of her iris and her skin, all of those things. It was such a great shot to start on. And when you prelapse sound, you feel even more disoriented, which was the goal there.
Talk to me a little bit about music and sound, so important in a horror film. What kind of prep did you do? Did you think, oh, I need to, you know, get the soundtrack for Hereditary or whatever to get some temp score, that kind of thing?
Our director, Laura, and composer, Ariel Marks, had worked together previously on a short, and they already had a shorthand when discussing the palette for this film. Laura had already recorded some things with Ariel, specifically with her own voice. And a lot of the music was a combination of Laura's vocals and Ariel's amazing arrangements. So they sent me a few tracks that I could play with in the offline. And it really informed a lot of the tone, a lot of creative decisions I decided to make, just because a lot of it was so out there and beautifully surreal. And so I took liberty with that in the cut and tried some out of the box ideas just because I heard the music. I was like, oh, this is crazy. All right. I know how far I can go. Let me try some things. In terms of the sound, it was just what I felt was right in the moment to help us tell the story. And Brian Parker, our sound designer, took that and elevated it so much. You had the same kind of sounds in the beginning under black of someone getting in an ambulance and the door shutting and all that. And he took it and transformed it with interesting guttural sounds and interesting medical instruments. So like he really put his spin on it and made it unique. You know, I had the help of a great team.
Talk to me about intercutting. Right after the opening titles, we're intercutting between surgery that's going on and this other doctor back and forth. Was that scripted to be intercut? And if it was scripted to be intercut, were there places where you diverged in where to make the edit and why?
That opening was scripted and storyboarded. And the song selected, I think, was also scripted. So I knew exactly how it was going to look, but the kind of pacing it had was still carefully crafted. How we moved from one shot to the next was more of a subjective choice. For example, I thought the deceased woman's foot transitioning into the newborn's needed to be treated gently. So I threw a longer crossfade from one to the other instead of cutting hard. I mean, I feel like I had a lot of options to choose from, even though I kind of knew what it was supposed to look like. What was shot was so beautiful, which made it easy for me to play around with in terms of how to get in and out of what was already pre-planned. And it was fun to do, even though I kind of knew how it was supposed to go before I saw the footage.
There were a lot of very unique shots that were more about the feeling than, oh, I have to make sure everybody understands the story from beginning to end. Can you talk about those choices and making them and what kind of coverage you had and deciding to use the footage that you used?
We really wanted to keep it visceral because there's a story and then there's the underlying themes. And one of them is bodily autonomy. We really wanted the audience to empathize with the women who lost their autonomy in this film. And it was important that the stakes around all the things that were happening to these women were understood and felt and not simply just used for plot. It was necessary for the audience to feel, even if it was pain, what these women were feeling. It's also interesting that if you're a male in the audience or identify as male in the audience, you can still feel the same kind of terror, even though it might not happen to you in a lifetime. So it was really important to make it a universal experience and to respect what was happening and not just be entertained by it.
That's an interesting idea, that bodily autonomy. I hadn't really thought about that. It's almost an entirely female cast doing these things to each other.
Yeah, which also emphasizes the kind of desperation that these women had to have just to be able to do something as drastic as stealing fetal tissue from pregnant women, knowing that it could just as easily be them in that situation. Having a mostly female cast really raises the stakes here.
There's some disturbing content, this bodily autonomy being one of them, or lack of bodily autonomy being one of them, and someone else having control of your body or seeming to. How did that affect you as you were working on this for as long as you were working on it? And did you have to protect yourself from that?
I ask myself that often. I almost think this is a question for my therapist, because sometimes I'm so shocked by how not shocked I am at a lot of this. Surprisingly, I didn't need to protect myself too much on this. That's not the case for everything, of course. I had finished Dahmer not too long before this, and that was definitely one where that was the exception. I had to protect myself, leave the chair every so often just to like take a breather, and then come back to it with fresh eyes and fresh mind. But in general, fear to me arises when there's a lack of control or when you don't have control in a situation. For Birth Rebirth, I think the fact that I could sit in front of the cut and manipulate it so easily, I didn't need to be protected from that, knowing that like I could kind of change this from a horror to comedy within 13 frames.
I want to see the comedy version of this movie.
I did too. I might do a second pass after this and create an E-bombs version. But anyway, it was great that I was surrounded by a team of horror heads, people who are horror fanatics. I mean, Laura has a catalog of films in their head that would put anyone to shame. And I felt pretty inadequate next to them as we were pulling references. They knew so many horror films and could just recite lines and scenes at like any given moment. I had to catch up quickly. There wasn't enough time in the day, honestly. Horror was the language that was used, and akin to that is Molly Elfman, who was our producer and director in her own right, and also daughter of famed composer Danny Elfman. And so she obviously brought her own horror sensibilities to this. I want to say this is a direct quote, but I feel like over breakfast one morning, she asked if we should have more bone marrow aspirations in the film. We contemplated this like very seriously over breakfast. So a lot of the language just became so commonplace that it just did away with the fear, and we were able to really just attack the story without being super affected ourselves until we needed to, really.
Can you remember any of the director's references that you felt either they wanted you to look up or know, or that you felt like you needed to watch?
Sisters was a big one. Dead Ringers was a major one for many reasons, primarily because there are two people whose relationship to one another is where the story lived. So I watched that a few times. Censor, Safe, and We Need to Talk About Kevin were a few more, but Dead Ringers was the main reference. And then I watched Dead Ringers, the series on Amazon after, you know, Birth Rebirth came out, and just the themes were so similar and so eerie. I think we did it justice. So
at the end of what's probably the first act, there's a death. Do you remember if that was shot and you chose not to use it, or was it a directorial choice to not even shoot it?
Not showing the death was a directorial choice, and it was a choice that I'm a fan of. I think the goal was to replicate the real human experience. And of course, how we experience death in real life is more often than not unseen. You know, it's just tragic in that someone you love is here one moment and then they're gone the next. There's no preparation or processing time beforehand. They're just ripped away.
It's just a phone call.
Yeah. And as an audience member who does not personally know this man, you know, are still feeling completely and utterly empty, just like our main character does. So we really wanted, one, for it to feel authentic, and two, for the audience to connect to Celie, so that they were affected by the death and also affected by the revival of this young girl.
There's not a lot of dialogue, especially in the first act. Is that a challenge to pace something when there's so little dialogue?
I'd say this is less of a challenge and more of a gift, because I love when exposition is told through a character's behavior. I think it's so much more interesting, and it requires the audience to have to interpret what they see on screen and therefore engage. Once the audience engages, they hopefully become invested in the outcome of their interpretation. So it's also kind of a device, but I also think it's just more fulfilling to lead with action than it is to directly tell the audience what's going on.
These pacing questions without the dialogue are really much more interesting, I think, because how long do you look at somebody looking into a microscope? How long do you stay with a mom lying in bed grieving over her daughter?
Some of these choices were to serve the scene that we're currently in, and some of them were to let us decompress from the scene we just left. A lot of these choices were emotional choices, and it was necessary to just sit with some of the characters for a second and see how they're internalizing things. It's such an out-of-this-world narrative. So it's necessary to see how these women are processing it and reacting to what's going on so we, the audience, can empathize with them.
This is kind of a similar question to the one I just asked, but at one point in the movie, a mom loses her child and she grieves, as anyone would, of course. How long do you allow the audience to grieve with her and to be there being affected by that? And when do you say, okay, we've got to get past the fact that she's sad and grieving. We need to move on with the plot.
Initially, the grieving process was supposed to be a little bit more substantial. We actually went back and forth on this and considered this moment quite a bit in the director's cut, and basically decided that it was better that Celie remained in shock, that she didn't fully accept the loss of her daughter, which didn't require much screen time. It was important for the moment, especially because we don't see it. It was important that the death of the daughter be so traumatic for Celie that she can't process it. Like, it's too traumatic to process. So she doesn't accept it. I mean, there's a moment where you get a little bit of emotion when she is listening to voice messages left by her daughter before she dies. But we were very careful about striking the right balance there. We didn't want to give the audience too much decompression time. So we just let her graze the surface of that grief and then cut right to the outside of the medical center, watching her go through the motions, barely there. It was necessary for us to create distance between her and grief in order to allow the audience to buy her getting on board with a big reveal of her daughter later on. She kind of easily accepts what's happening when Rose explains the experiment. She accepts it very quickly, and normally people would ask questions and be a little angrier, but she just gets right on board with her daughter breathing through a tube because she never really accepted that her daughter was dead. So all these kind of decisions are carefully balanced in the edit, one scene at a time. It was a fun math problem, I'd say.
A fun math problem. Okay. There's a quote right there. You mentioned the script a couple of times. Did you get a chance to, I'm assuming, read that before you chose to work on this project? And was that one of the things that really drew you to working on it?
Absolutely. I read the script. I was reading it while I was getting my hair done, and I had so many verbal just reactions to this, just yelps and oh my gods and, you know, what the hells. And my hairdresser was like, is everything okay? Like, do we need a break? So basically it was a thrill to read on the page. And I immediately was like, yes, please. I will pay you to cut this, actually. I just loved how well considered it was. I loved the personalities of the women. I loved all of the underlying themes. And it was just so well thought out. And I knew the director knew what they were doing. So I was on board immediately. I don't even think I finished the second act before I was texting my friend, telling her, yes, I want to do this.
You were texting a friend. So how did you get this gig, or why were you texting your friend?
I don't know if you've interviewed with Kayla Emter.
I know who that is.
We went to AFI together. She was a mentor for a while, mentor turned friend. And she's the one that recommended me for this. I think she was working on something else. So I was texting her, yes, I'm down, before I even finished the script. And then when I did, they set up a meeting with Laura and Molly, and I was gushing. So thank you, Kayla.
Only in LA is there some hairdresser saying, so this woman is reading the script while I'm doing her hair. And I want to talk about a really micro thing here. There's a great shot of Muriel, the pig, as it walks past a doorway. And you didn't choose to show the whole walk. You barely see her tail before she walks out of the frame. That's a conscious choice, obviously. Why choose that?
That, along with some of the other moments in this film, was crafted that way in part to create intrigue. I wanted to show the audience this was just the tip of the iceberg for Celie and for them. I really wanted them to know that there's something weird going on here, and this is just the beginning, and there will be more. And it's answered shortly after that when you see like the whole pig, but then we up the ante when you see then the IV bag connected to the pig. So you get the answer, and then you get another question right on top of that. And it just keeps the ball rolling and keeps us engaged. And yeah, I always love a little hint of something, a promise to anticipate being revealed later on in the film.
As editors, I always think that empathy is a big reason why we are editors, one of the reasons why we're good at editing. And there's one of the characters who's not expressive in the way that most people are expressive. How do you watch that performance and relate to it, or use that lack of reacting like a quote-unquote normal person? How do you choose true moments for that character?
Ironically, I really relate to that character more than anyone else in the film. I think most people would disagree, but I think it's because I mask very, very well. So, like, a lot like the character in the film, daily communication is kind of, with all of its nuances, is so painstakingly challenging for me. Except for this one. Wait, you're delightful, and I'm so happy to be here. Generally, it is a challenge. And so I was able to relate to the character a bit. And also, the spectrum is so wide and ever present, especially in this industry, that I've just had exposure to, you know, a myriad of personalities and behaviors, and some that I can relate to, some that I can't. But it's been super helpful when I'm watching dailies and seeing these same behaviors on screen. I can kind of easily identify, you know, when someone's feeling sad or mad or angry, and how to kind of capture that. Now, it is important, even with my personal experience, to make sure a character's performance is still balanced, because I feel like if there is too much of Rose's quirks on screen, it could feel a little exploitative. And if I cut out of her too soon, it could feel like we're not crafting the authentic character we want. So there's still a balance to maintain, and I make those decisions one moment at a time. But it is still really helpful that I can relate to some of those tough social experiences.
There's a scene where the two characters are talking about their childhood and about how they kind of got to be who they are and where they are. And one of them tells this great story about a starfish. And it seems like a lovely story is going to be told, and then it kind of goes south.
I loved that moment. It's where our two main characters take a breather and we learn more about who Rose is, and also learn more about Celie based on her reactions to Rose and just how gentle she is with her. So with Rose usually being so rigid and intense, this vulnerability was an important moment in her arc. It also sowed the seeds of her mom, who plays an important role later on in the film. It's this moment where the two women really connect and they see each other finally outside of their shared purpose and common goal to revive this young girl. But in general, this scene marks the beginning of their journey together. And it's like an odd couple's relationship that grows throughout the film. It really is one of the kinder moments in the film for me, and definitely put a smile on my face while I was cutting it.
Tell me about using the reactions that you did, because I love the reactions, Celie's reactions about kind of expecting the story to go one way, and then when it doesn't, she almost does a spit take. The reactions are absolutely priceless.
Great. I mean, I think they're the reactions that I would make. And I recognize Celie's reaction and a lot of my family members, and Judy Reyes is fantastic and super talented. Her timing is so on point. And when I saw the reaction, I thought, that's how my sister would react to that. Or that's the kind of smirk I've seen my cousin make before. And then I'll put the reaction in with a little pause for some judgment and the laugh that I'm so familiar with, and keep it moving. Murrin Ireland, who plays Rose, gave me so much to work with. Like, she plays Rose's quirks so naturally and unexpectedly. And it was equally great to have Judy bounce off of that with her reactions and expose even more to the audience by just reacting the way she did.
A lot of times reaction shots kind of help you show almost how the audience is feeling.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
In comedy, they're my favorite. A deadpan looks, I've cried laughing at some of those. There's a lot of juice in reactions.
I love the fact that there are almost no transition shots in this movie. When you go from one time to another, one day to another, one location to another, there are a couple of establishing shots, but man, I can't think of maybe more than three in the whole movie. Talk to me about not needing those, realizing that you don't need them, or did you have them and you chose not to use them?
There was even less establishing shots that were scripted, and we ended up putting them in there just to kind of reestablish tone or to offer moments of decompression for the audience. But originally, some of those weren't in. But I think you're right. There are about three or four even tops. Transitions were limited, mostly because they were unnecessary for the story, especially a story with elements that are actually a bit disparate. they're very different. And being interwoven, making any unnecessary transition choice would disrupt that. It's such an important balance that any little extra texture, however stylized or not, could mess up the balance. And so, unless necessary, we kept it cut and dry. If I did use transitions that were stylized, it would have been purely superficial and wouldn't have benefited the audience at all.
I remember one hard cut on music. Celie's looking at some photos that are in a box and she puts on a record. And when you go to the next scene, it is like razor sharp, cutting right to the next scene visually and audio.
I have the benefit of the audience in this being able to fill in the gaps. And so when I cut out of something in the middle of it, I'm basically depending on the audience to, in their minds, come to the conclusion that Celie finished cleaning and Celie finished listening to the music and so on. So it's not real estate I have to use. The audience is doing it for me in almost a split second. And when the very next frame I cut to is of a completely different tone, like it's silent, Celie is now sitting still and background noise sounds different, room tone feels warmer, etc. You get the sense that time has passed. You have all these little tiny elements that instinctively feel different, like in your body, it feels different. And so we're able to show the audience that it's a different time of day without adding some Chiron that says Wednesday, 7 p.m., etc. That's what I love about the craft. I mean, there are just so many creative ways to communicate to the audience and evoke feelings. And it's just fun to try to figure out which ones to use and when and how.
The tone of the movie is very, I'm trying to think of a word other than eerie.
Accurate.
One of the things that I noticed as a former colorist is that the color of the film is so unique. Were you editing with dailies that were colored something close to the way the film ended up? And did that help you in your cutting?
Yes, we used a LUT. Our DP, Shauna Nonshotrun Groge, was fantastic, and I really hope I can work with her again. Her work was so inspiring, and the LUT she chose was great, and it was really close to how they ended up grading. And yeah, it definitely changed the tone for me in a lot of these scenes. It informed a lot of the cutting decisions I would make because of how brooding and dark it felt at times. And in some cases, because it felt dark, I would ease off of a close-up a bit or maybe make it a little less intense because the color spoke for us. It's really nice, I think, to have a LUT. It's really nice to have, you know, music already kind of established, especially on such a short schedule. It makes it easier. It really does help you get into the mindset and tone that the director is going for. It makes it easier. And then you can really focus more on story.
There's an event that takes place almost exactly at the halfway point. I'll say it's when the daughter kind of sits up and Celie discovers her awake. Was that planned editorially to happen right at the midpoint, or was it just pacing of the script and that kind of thing, and it's the way it worked out?
No, I mean, we actually had another thread in the film that, had it been included, would have murkied or undermined the overall story. It was a thread completely outside of our main characters that was very good, and it was compelling and well acted, but including it would have ended up adding confusion to the overall story. So because of this change, the moment where the daughter sits up just so happens to be the dead center of the film.
How far into the process were you when you realized that thread had to go? And that must have been a difficult decision for you and the director.
Yeah, especially because it was such great texture. But I mean, there's always so much you want to say in a film all the time. Letting go of a really compelling thread is tough, but if it's going to be in service to the larger story, then it's necessary. I always try to tell myself that, hey, we can do a second film. You know what I mean? Like, it never has to go away. Like, you can tell stories until you're blue in the face. It never has to end. It just has to end here.
Taylor, I'm going to ask you a personal question. You talked about how you're not sure about your own personal interactions and if you react the way other people would react. When you've got to sit down with your director and pitch yourself, obviously you've been highly recommended for the job, but you still got to do the interview. How do you navigate that?
Well, it isn't as difficult when I focus on the material. If I'm excited about the material, it's really easy to talk about. And especially if I connect with it, I can pull from my own experiences and share them very easily without hesitation. I felt connected the moment I finished the script. And then it certainly helps when the person I'm talking to is easygoing and down to earth and has a sense of humor, which I could also tell from reading the script. And so I didn't go into it feeling super anxious, knowing that I was going to be excited about the subject matter. I got the sense that the person I was going to be talking to would be a pretty cool person. And the moments when that's not the case, I think it's just challenging. But as long as I kind of stay honest and true to how I think and feel about whatever material I'm talking about, I can get through it in one piece.
Sounds like the idea is to focus on the material.
Yeah. And which is kind of why we're there. So it works out quite well.
You were working on Dahmer shortly before this one, so that wasn't too much whiplash. But I think it's hysterical that the whiplash is to Black Lady Sketch Show to this. I mean, wow.
I mean, there was a moment where I just sat and stared at the ceiling and was like, is this healthy? This could make me a better person, or I could just go off the rails after this. It's interesting to look back on that time and see how I maneuvered through all that, but I don't think that will happen again. I'm going to be kinder to myself, I think, in the future and just give myself some space between projects if I'm able. But I am thankful that I have the ability to cut both extremes. I love that, and I want to keep testing that and keep honing those skills. So we'll see.
I've heard from many people that they feel like they get pigeonholed, and it's very hard to look at your work and see that you're being pigeonholed.
I might be pigeonholing myself because I am looking into more horrors. I had such a good experience on Birth Rebirth and with the crew. And so I might be doing myself a disservice by cutting more horror. But regardless, it is good to know that people are aware that I'm capable of cutting other genres. Most editors can cut all genres. If you can cut, you can cut. It's just probably a lot easier for people to pigeonhole us as a way of making the hiring process easier. But hopefully more exposure to the craft and discussions like this can help push against that, show the world that a good editor is a good editor.
Amen. Absolutely. Cut on Avid?
Oh, yeah. I learned on Avid and dabbled in Final Cut and dabbled in Premiere, but I felt like I had more range. I could tailor my experience in Avid a little bit more. And so now I'm just kind of a devout Avidist. I mean, it's necessary to learn other platforms. It just is. You don't want to limit yourself and your opportunities. But if I have the choice, it'll be Avid.
To me, the different NLEs feel almost like different languages. How do you feel about it? I feel like I'm better speaking English, but if I had to speak French, I could do it.
That's a great analogy. I think Avid has a bigger lexicon, in my opinion. And it's just, it gives me options. I don't feel like my back is against the wall and I have to do one thing one way. It gives me so many options to do one thing. And I like that. I just like that it can be a very personal, technical experience.
I'm assuming something with what I'm guessing the budget of this was, and because there was so little dialogue, you didn't really use ScriptSync.
I did use ScriptSync.
You did?
Yeah, like you said, there wasn't a lot of dialogue, but there was still description and whatever action we had that was also scripted too, which was necessary just because our schedule was really short. Our goal was to get to Sundance. And so it was really tight. I think about 6 weeks, which is wild. So ScriptSync really helped us in crunch time and auditioning takes and swapping things out. So I will never not use that if I, had that option.
Do you want to give a shout out to your assistant editor who must have done a ton of work on that?
Shout out to Liz Berganza, who is not a horror fan. So I want to apologize to her and kudos for making it through the end of this process. I know it couldn't have been easy, but you killed it, pun intended. And I don't know what I'd do without you.
Taylor, it's so good chatting with you. I could talk to you all day, but I want to let you enjoy the rest of your day. So hopefully we'll get to see each other again real soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Another hike.
That's it for Art of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a Topic-Driven Curated Look at the Craft of Editing. Thanks to Taylor Mason, ACE, for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.